I have begun this record on the 43rd hour after the catastrophe. The machine spirits demand documentation. Logic dictates that even if we perish, the Omnissiah may guide another Imperial vessel to recover this data slate. The Emperor's knowledge must persist, even as we fade. Our voidship fervent decree died with a scream of tortured metal. We were 3 months into our patrol of the Halo Star's outer reaches when the plasma containment field in Engine Room 7 collapsed. No warnings preceded the failure. No logical explanation has yet been found. One moment the cruiser sliced through the void with all systems operating within acceptable parameters. The next, a cascade of energy tore through three decks, vaporizing bulkheads, crew, and critical systems with indiscriminate fury. I was performing routine maintenance on a cogitator bank in the tertiary command center when the ship lurched violently. The artificial gravity fluctuated, sending my tools floating momentarily before they clattered back to the deck. The emergency klaxons never sounded. They too had been severed from their power source. 183 crew members died in the initial breach. Among them was Navigator Helios Vor, whose quarters were located directly above the primary plasma conduit. Without a navigator, we cannot enter the warp. Without the warp, we cannot return to Imperial space within our lifetimes. This is the first immutable fact of our predicament. The ship's machine spirit has been gravely wounded. I commune with it hourly, pressing my mechadendrites against its sacred interfaces, whispering the proper mantras, applying the sacred unguents. It responds with fragmented binary cant, corrupted data streams, and occasional surges of power that threaten the few functioning systems we have left. Something beyond mere mechanical failure afflicts it. The plasma breach damaged more than circuitry and metal. It has wounded the vessel's very soul. Cogitators across all decks malfunction unpredictably. Data storage units randomly purge centuries of accumulated knowledge. Targeting arrays activate without command, draining precious power as they track phantom enemies. The void shields, our primary defense against both material threats and radiation, remain completely offline despite my most fervent prayers to the Omnissiah. Life support functions at precisely 23% efficiency. Recyclers labor to extract oxygen from the increasingly stale air. Water purification systems struggle to process the liquid we recover from the dead. Temperature regulation has failed in almost all compartments, creating pockets of freezing cold and stifling heat throughout the vessel. The fervent decree has become a maze of environmental hazards. Captain Veritak survived the initial disaster, though a falling support beam shattered his left leg. The Medicaid servitors set the bone, but with limited medical supplies, he refused pain suppressants. I observed him limping through the corridors during the first damage assessment, his face gray with pain but his posture unbending. The captain's first decree was implemented within 6 hours of the catastrophe. All non-essential systems were to be powered down immediately. Most of the command crew perished in the breach. The captain now relies heavily on the remaining senior officers, Commissar Draylock, Master Gunner Thalvik, and myself. As the highest-ranking tech priest aboard, I have inherited duties far beyond my ordained station. The Omnissiah tests me severely. Veritak ordered the ship's astropath, Savin Merrick, to transmit continuous distress signals. I calculated the power expenditure and deemed it acceptable, despite our critical reserves. For 48 hours, Merrick sat in her sanctum, blood seeping from her eyes as she screamed our coordinates into the void. On the third day, she collapsed, her mind burned out by the effort. Before losing consciousness, she conveyed to the captain what I had already calculated. We were too far from any Imperial presence for her signals to reach. The astropath now lies in a coma in the Medicaid Bay, another drain on our dwindling resources. The captain ordered a complete inventory of our supplies. I led a team of 7 servitors through every storage compartment, counting ration packs, water recycling cartridges, oxygen canisters, and promethium reserves. The data I compiled was processed through my augmetic brain hemispheres and cross-referenced with the ship's damaged databases. The conclusion was inescapable. With 237 surviving crew members, our supplies would last approximately 47 standard Terran days, assuming optimal conservation protocols. This calculation assumed reduced life support, minimal movement throughout the ship, and the implementation of cold sleep protocols for non-essential personnel. Even with every possible conservation measure, the numbers remained inflexible. The nearest Imperial outpost, a minor listening station at the edge of the Gothic sector, lay approximately 180 days away at our maximum sublight speed. The mathematics of our situation allowed for no error, no hope, no salvation through conventional means. I presented these calculations to Captain Veritax in the makeshift command center we established in Cargo Hold 3, where emergency power generators still functioned. The captain's face remained impassive as I detailed our circumstances, though the biometric scanners in my ocular implants detected elevated heart rate and stress hormones. When I finished my report, he sat in silence for precisely 247 seconds, then activated the ship-wide Vox system. Veritax announced new protocols to the surviving crew. All personnel would be limited to one-quarter rations. Non-essential compartments would be sealed to preserve atmospheric integrity. Movement between decks would require written authorization. All off-duty crew were to remain in their quarters, minimizing oxygen consumption. These measures might extend our survival by perhaps 12 days. It was insufficient. In the days that followed, I continued my attempts to restore the ship's critical systems. My efforts yielded minimal success. The plasma breach had not merely damaged our systems, it had corrupted them at a fundamental level. Circuitry that appeared intact would fail when power was applied. Machine spirits that should have responded to the proper rituals remained silent or screamed in binary gibberish. On the seventh day after the catastrophe, I made a discovery that altered our calculations further. The nutrient recyclers had been irreparably damaged. The protein reclamation units could no longer process our waste into edible matter. Without this technology, our food supplies would last barely 30 days, not the 47 I had initially calculated. I brought this information to the captain immediately. His quarters had been converted into a command post, with data slates and parchment maps covering every surface. The temperature had dropped to conserve power, and his breath formed white clouds in the frigid air. Veritax reviewed my findings without comment, then dismissed me with instructions to continue repairs. That night, the first fights broke out among the crew. Two ratings from the engine decks attacked a supply officer, believing he was hoarding ration packs. Commissar Draylock executed both attackers with his bolt pistol. The sound of the shots echoed through the ship's corridors, a stark reminder of Imperial authority even in our desperate circumstances. The next morning, I found the captain studying the crew manifest. He had marked certain names with a red stylus. When he noticed my presence, he quickly covered the document. His orders were brief. I was to calculate exactly how many crew members could be sustained for 180 days with our current supplies. When I provided the answer, approximately 62 individuals, he nodded once and returned to his manifest. By the 12th day, power reserves had dropped to 31% despite our conservation efforts. The ship drifted through the void, its engines dormant except for occasional course corrections to maintain our heading toward Imperial space. I spent 18 hours daily in communion with the vessel's damaged systems, replacing burnt-out circuits with components harvested from non-essential areas. During one such repair session in the primary life support hub, I discovered evidence that troubled my logical processes. The initial plasma containment failure showed signs of deliberate tampering. Microscopic tool marks on crucial power couplings suggested sabotage rather than mechanical failure. I found no reference to scheduled maintenance in that section during the period preceding the catastrophe. I brought this information to the captain, expecting him to order an investigation. Instead, he instructed me to continue repairs and speak of my discovery to no one. His behavior registered as anomalous in my threat assessment protocols, but I complied with his directive. The Mechanicus teaches that the machine is superior to human emotion precisely because it does not question the orders of properly designated authorities. On the 15th day, Master Gunner Thalvik was found dead in his quarters. The official report cited oxygen deprivation due to a localized life support failure. My examination of his body revealed a more disturbing truth. His throat had been cut with precision, severing the carotid artery with minimal blood spray. The weapon used was consistent with a surgical instrument from the Medicay Bay. The captain ordered the body taken to the recycling chambers. No service was held. No investigation was launched. Thalvik's personal effects were distributed among the senior officers, his water ration redirected to life support maintenance. That night, I received a coded transmission on my private Vox frequency. The message contained a single set of coordinates within the ship and a time. My logic engines calculated a 78.3% probability of a trap, but curiosity, a human weakness I have yet to fully excise, compelled me to investigate. The coordinates led to a sealed storage compartment near the damaged engine section. The radiation levels there discouraged casual exploration. I arrived at the designated time, my rad counter clicking steadily as it measured the ambient contamination. The door opened before I could announce my presence. Inside stood Commissar Draylock and three other officers I recognized from the command deck. They had arranged storage crates in a rough circle. A data slate lay on each makeshift seat. The Commissar gestured for me to join them without speaking. The data slate contained Captain Veritax's new survival protocol. It detailed, with clinical precision, how the crew would be reduced to a sustainable number through selective life support deactivation in crew quarters. The captain had divided the ship's personnel into three categories: essential, conditional, and expendable. The plan called for the immediate termination of all crew members in the expendable category, 137 individuals. My name appeared in the essential category. The captain had valued my technical expertise above most of the command staff. This knowledge provided no comfort as I processed the implications of the document before me. The officers in that radiation-soaked chamber had formed a counter plan. They believed the captain's judgment had been compromised, possibly by the same individual who had sabotaged the plasma containment field. They required my technical expertise to implement their alternative, a ship-wide lottery, with cold sleep pods for those chosen to survive, and a humane end for those who would sacrifice themselves for the good of the vessel. I sit now in my quarters, this data slate recording my thoughts as I calculate probabilities and outcomes. The ship's chronometer shows 22 days since the catastrophe. Power reserves continue to diminish. Temperature has dropped another 3 degrees ship-wide. The recyclers strain to extract oxygen from the increasingly toxic atmosphere. Tomorrow, the captain will implement his protocol. Tomorrow, the conspirators will attempt to seize control. Tomorrow, I must choose a side, knowing that regardless of my decision, human beings will die to feed the living. The Omnissiah teaches that all flesh is weakness, but even my augmented mind struggles with the calculations before me. The fervent decree drifts through the void, a coffin carrying the still breathing. I can hear the ship's machine spirit whispering through the walls, its binary cant increasingly resembling screams. Perhaps it knows what we will become before this journey ends. The Strategium resembled a tomb more than a command center. Emergency lumens cast long shadows across the tactical display table, their flickering illumination giving the gathered officers' faces a cadaverous quality. Captain Veritax had summoned us 14 hours after my previous entry. His face had grown gaunt in the intervening time, cheekbones pressing against pallid skin like a death mask. The fracture in his leg had begun to fester despite the Medicaid's efforts, and the infection's sweet rot smell followed him through the ship's corridors. I stood at the periphery of the gathering, my ocular augmetics recording the proceedings for the ship's damaged archives. The remaining command staff had arranged themselves in a rough semicircle around the captain. Commissar Draylock's tall figure loomed near the entrance, bolt pistol visible at his hip. His eyes constantly scanned the room as though expecting assassination at any moment. Perhaps he was not wrong to do so. The captain activated the hololithic projector at the center of the Strategium. It sputtered twice before stabilizing, the machine's spirit within clearly damaged. My augmetic hand twitched with the urge to perform the proper rites of appeasement, but I remained still. Now was not the time for such observances. The projection displayed what remained of the fervent decree. Vast sections glowed crimson, indicating catastrophic damage or complete structural failure. Nearly half the ship was now sealed off, either exposed to void or contaminated with lethal radiation levels. The life support systems still functioning were marked in pale green, shrinking islands in a sea of death. Veritax gestured toward me with a trembling hand. The captain requested that I present my findings to the assembled officers. I stepped forward, interfacing directly with the hololithic projector through my data tether. The display shifted, showing my calculations in stark numerical precision. My presentation was clinical and precise. The fervent decree possessed 47 functional stasis chambers, but 5 were damaged beyond my ability to repair with available resources. Our remaining supplies, even with optimal recycling protocols and complete protein reclamation from the deceased, could sustain 42 crew members in low power stasis for approximately 184 standard days, the minimum time required to reach the nearest Imperial outpost at our maximum sustainable sublight speed. The mathematics were irrefutable. Of our remaining 237 crew members, 195 would need to be processed through the ship's recycler units to sustain the survivors. I used the technical term biomass conversion, but everyone in the room understood the meaning. We would consume our dead, and then we would consume the living. The temperature in the stratagium seemed to drop several degrees as my presentation concluded. I observed micro expressions of horror, disgust, and fear flash across the faces of the assembled officers. Only Commissar Draylock's features remained impassive, though my biometric scanners detected elevated heart rate and perspiration. The command council fractured immediately into competing factions. Chief Warrant Officer Hadrian, representing the naval officers, argued that selection should be based on rank and essential skills. His logic was sound from a purely operational perspective. Those with specialized knowledge necessary for the ship's continued function must be preserved. He produced a list he had already prepared, which unsurprisingly included himself and most of the senior naval personnel. Mago's militant Zaris, one of the 3 surviving Mechanicus adepts, countered with cold machine logic. Those with extensive augmetic modifications required fewer biological resources. Their partially mechanical bodies consumed less oxygen, required less water, and could operate more efficiently on reduced caloric intake. The Omnissiah had already marked its chosen through the blessing of steel. His argument was statistically valid, though I noted he failed to mention that all 3 remaining tech priests, including myself, possessed significant augmentations. Commissar Draylock's rebuttal came as a surprise. He strode to the center of the stratagium, his greatcoat swirling around his tall frame. The Emperor's will, he insisted, could not be discerned through human hierarchy or machine logic. Only random selection, a ship-wide lottery, would truly honor the God Emperor's divine plan. Each crew member would receive a single chance, regardless of rank or augmentation. The Emperor would guide the selection process through the random operation of the ship's cogitators. The debate grew heated. Voices rose in pitch and volume as each faction defended its position. I observed the captain's vital signs through my augmetics. His heart rate had increased dangerously, and infection markers in his bloodstream had risen by 17% since my last scan. Yet he made no move to quell the argument, merely watching with glassy eyes as his command staff tore into one another with increasing vitriol. After precisely 27 minutes of debate, Captain Veritax finally raised his hand for silence. His decision was unexpected but logical. The first selection would begin immediately, but with volunteers, the mortally wounded and terminally irradiated crew who had no chance of survival regardless of our decision. The Medicay Bay contained 16 such individuals, their bodies beyond salvation, even had we possessed a fully functional medical deck. Their sacrifice would buy us time to determine the final selection process. I was tasked with overseeing the modifications to the recycler units. The ship's protein reclamation systems had been designed for processing organic waste, not human bodies. Significant adjustments would be necessary to optimize nutrient extraction and prevent contamination of the resulting biomass paste. The work was technically challenging but spiritually troubling. As I reprogrammed the reclamation protocols and calibrated the molecular filters, I found myself reciting the litany of purification continuously. My human components required this psychological comfort, though my augmetic brain recognized it as irrational. The recyclers were merely machines, performing their designated function without moral consideration. The flesh they processed was simply matter being converted to a more useful form. I completed the modifications in 7 hours, working without rest. The efficiency of the system had been improved by 23.4% through my efforts. I calculated that each processed body would provide approximately 12.7 days of sustenance for a single crew member in stasis, assuming optimal extraction and minimal spoilage. The mathematics were elegant in their horror. The first processing cycle began at ship's midnight. The Medicaid staff had administered Emperor's Peace to the volunteers, ensuring they experienced no pain as their bodies were transported to the reclamation chamber. I supervised the process personally, monitoring the machine spirits for any sign of malfunction. They performed their duty without complaint, though I detected unusual harmonic patterns in their operational hymns, almost like mourning. Chief Medicaid Loris observed the procedure with me, his ancient face impassive as the first body disappeared into the intake mechanism. The recycler's grinding mechanisms were mercifully quiet, the sound dampened by the thick plasteel walls of the chamber. Only a low hum indicated that the machine was functioning. 37 minutes later, the first canister of nutrient paste emerged from the output port. It was a pale, pinkish-gray substance with the consistency of thick gruel. Loris performed the necessary tests to confirm its safety and nutritional content before applying the Imperial seal to the container. I found myself unable to watch as the remaining bodies were processed. This weakness troubled me. The Mechanicus teaches that flesh is irrelevant, merely a temporary housing for consciousness until it can be transferred to the purity of the machine. Yet something in my remaining human components rebelled at the systematic conversion of my fellow crew members into sustenance. I retreated to the monitoring station, focusing on the data streams rather than the physical process. By ship's morning, all 16 volunteers had been processed. The resulting nutrient canisters were sealed and stored in the secure hold adjacent to the stasis chambers. I calculated that we had gained approximately 203 days of sustenance for a single crew member, enough to sustain 4 people until potential rescue. It was a start, but woefully insufficient. Captain Veritax reconvened the command council the following day. The debate over selection criteria resumed with increased intensity. Commissar Draylock's lottery proposal had gained support among the lower-ranking crew members, who correctly understood that any merit-based system would likely exclude them. The naval officers remained adamant that rank and specialization should determine survival. The Mechanicus contingent continued to advocate for selection based on augmentation level. Throughout the ship, I began noting disturbing patterns in crew behavior. My security routines detected unauthorized access attempts at multiple supply caches. Surveillance servitors reported increased movement in supposedly abandoned sections of the vessel. Most concerning, my inventory protocols identified a discrepancy in oxygen canister counts. 12 units had disappeared from the main storage bay without proper authorization. I brought these findings to the captain privately after the council meeting. His reaction was concerning. Rather than ordering an investigation, he simply nodded and dismissed my report. His biometric readings showed elevated stress hormones and decreased cognitive function. The infection in his leg had spread despite aggressive treatment, and I calculated a 73.6% probability that septic shock would claim him within 14 standard days. The missing supplies suggested that some crew members had already decided to take survival into their own hands. The lower decks, with their maze of maintenance tunnels and storage compartments, provided ample hiding places for small groups. My thermal scans detected unauthorized heat signatures in sections that should have been abandoned. Someone was establishing survival enclaves outside the command structure's knowledge or control. Paranoia spread through the crew like a virus. Mess hall gatherings grew silent when officers approached. Crew members traveled in groups, even for routine duties. Weapons disappeared from the armory, small, concealable items like combat knives and hand flamers. The ship's Vox system recorded a 217% increase in private communications, many using non-standard encryption protocols I could not easily decode. My own position became increasingly precarious. As the architect of the recycling process, many crew members viewed me with naked hostility. The human components of my brain registered their fear and disgust, though my augmetic systems calculated that their reaction was illogical. We were all subject to the same implacable mathematics. The recyclers would claim most of us eventually, regardless of rank or augmentation. 72 hours after the first processing cycle, I discovered evidence of a more organized resistance forming in the lower decks. My maintenance servitors reported sabotage to monitoring systems in 3 separate sections. Security picked feeds had been looped or disabled. Motion sensors had been carefully dismantled rather than destroyed, suggesting technical expertise among the dissidents. Most disturbing was the discovery of a makeshift shrine in an abandoned storage compartment near the plasma drive housing. The radiation levels there were elevated but not immediately lethal, providing a natural deterrent against casual discovery. The shrine contained no imperial iconography, no aquila, no images of the god emperor. Instead, crude symbols had been carved into the metal bulkheads, patterns that triggered warning protocols in my augmetic brain. I recognized elements of forbidden knowledge, geometries that violated normal space, mathematical sequences that produced cognitive dissonance when processed. I purged the compartment with a hand flamer and sealed it with my highest level encryption codes. The incident remained unreported in my official logs. Some knowledge was too dangerous to share, even with the command structure. The implications of such a shrine aboard our vessel were too disturbing to contemplate. Had our isolation driven some crew members to seek comfort in prohibited beliefs, or had something been festering aboard the Fervent Decree long before our catastrophe? As I returned to my quarters to update this record, I passed the Medicay Bay. Through the half-open door, I observed Chief Medicay Loris examining Captain Veritax's infected leg. The wound had blackened, necrotic tissue spreading visibly up the thigh. The captain's face was gray with pain, his lips moving in what appeared to be silent prayer. Our commanding officer was dying by increments, even as the ship's command structure disintegrated around him. The Emperor's mathematics remained immutable. 237 lives, 42 survival slots, 195 deaths required for the continuation of the few. The numbers haunted my calculations, appearing unbidden in my visual field as my augmetic brain processed survival scenarios. The cold equations offered no comfort, no salvation beyond the stark truth. Most of us would die so that some might live. And somewhere in the lower decks, unknown parties prepared their own solution to the mathematical problem we all faced. The frost on the bulkheads had spread like a fungal infection, crystalline patterns etching themselves across the metal surfaces of the Fervent Decree. I observed these formations with detached interest as I made my morning rounds through the primary corridors. My augmetic temperature sensors registered negative 12 degrees Celsius in the outer passageways, a deliberate power-saving measure that had transformed much of the ship into a freezing tomb. The crew now moved through these areas in full void suits, their breath forming dense clouds inside their helmets, the sound of their footsteps muffled by the growing ice. Ship's discipline had degraded in precise correlation with the dropping temperature. My data logs documented quite a few incidents of insubordination in the past 48 hours alone. Minor infractions at first, crew members refusing to return to quarters during designated rest periods, unauthorized access to food storage compartments, small groups gathering in violation of assembly restrictions. But the pattern was clear and the progression mathematically predictable. The Fervent Decree was experiencing societal breakdown at an accelerating rate. Captain Veritax had ceased making public appearances 4 days ago. The infection in his leg had spread to his bloodstream despite aggressive treatment with our dwindling medical supplies. Chief Medicay Loris had amputated the limb in a desperate attempt to halt the progression, but sepsis had already taken hold. The captain now drifted in and out of consciousness, his orders increasingly incoherent when he was lucid enough to give them. Commissar Draylock had assumed de facto command, though he maintained the fiction of consulting the captain for all major decisions. The recycler units worked continuously now. Their mechanical drone had become the heartbeat of the ship, a constant reminder of our desperate measures. In the 15 days since my last entry, 37 crew members had been processed through the reclamation systems. Some were volunteers, the terminally ill, the severely injured, those whose radiation exposure guaranteed a slow, painful death. Others were selected through the compromise system the Command Council had finally implemented, a weighted lottery that factored in both essential skills and random chance. I supervised each processing cycle personally. The machine spirits of the recyclers had developed concerning behavioral patterns, requiring constant adjustment and ritual appeasement. Perhaps they sensed the moral weight of their new purpose. Or perhaps, as was more likely, the spiritual contamination of our actions had begun to affect the technology itself. The Omnissiah teaches that all machines possess a fragment of consciousness. These recyclers now consumed human flesh daily. What effect might this have on their mechanical souls? My own position aboard the ship had become increasingly complicated. My augmetic body required significantly fewer resources than my fully human counterparts. I consumed 1/4 the oxygen, 1/3 the water, and could subsist on minimal caloric intake for extended periods. These modifications ensured my continued survival under the selection protocols. I would live while those with less metal in their flesh would die. This logical outcome created an unexpected emotional response in my remaining biological components. I experienced what the Medicae would term survivor's guilt, an irrational but persistent sensation of responsibility for others' deaths. This was, of course, a weakness of the flesh. The Mechanicus teaches that such emotional responses are inefficient and ultimately detrimental to the pursuit of knowledge, yet I could not purge this sensation from my system. The burden grew heavier with each new list I compiled. As the ship's senior tech priest, I was responsible for calculating optimal survival probabilities based on our dwindling resources. Each day, I presented Commissar Draylock with updated projections and recommendations for crew reduction. My cogitators processed the data with cold efficiency, weighing each life against resource consumption rates and essential skill requirements. The resulting lists determined who would live and who would become sustenance for the survivors. The morning's calculations had been particularly difficult. Power reserves had dropped another 4.7% overnight despite our conservation efforts. At the current consumption rate, we would lose life support in non-essential areas within 12 days. This required another round of crew optimization, the euphemism Draylock now used for selecting recycling candidates. My data slate contained the names of crew members I had served alongside for decades. Petty Officer Merrick, who had assisted me in recalibrating the ship's auger arrays during the HRUD incursion of 928. Engine Seer Thule, whose knowledge of plasma containment systems rivaled my own, but whose fully human body required too many resources to justify his continued survival. Sister Hospitaller Venya, whose medical skills were valuable but duplicated by other personnel with more extensive augmetics. I transmitted the list to Commissar Draylock's private data channel, then made my way toward the lower decks. The temperature dropped further as I descended through the ship's levels. Frost covered every surface here, transforming the metal corridors into glittering ice caves. My mechanical limbs functioned without impediment, but I observed human crew members struggling to maintain their footing on the slippery surfaces. Several had suffered fractures from falls in recent days, injuries that automatically placed them higher on the recycling candidate list. The void suits that crew members now wore constantly had not been designed for prolonged use. Their power packs depleted quickly, requiring frequent recharging at the few functioning stations scattered throughout the ship. This created bottlenecks where crew members gathered, waiting their turn at the charging ports. These gatherings had become hotbeds of dissent. Whispered conversations ceased when I approached, but my enhanced audio receptors caught fragments of rebellion and desperation. My inspection route took me past Recycling Chamber 3, where the day's processing was underway. A line of 8 crew members stood outside the chamber, each wearing the red identification band that marked them as selected candidates. Guards flanked them, shot cannons at the ready. The atmosphere was tense but resigned. Most selected crew had stopped fighting their fate, understanding the mathematical inevitability of our situation. One face in the line caught my attention. Chief Petty Officer Dorn had served aboard the Fervent Decree for 32 years. His expertise in void shield harmonics had saved the ship during the Eldar ambush near the Sable Nebula. I had personally removed his name from 3 previous selection lists, citing his irreplaceable knowledge. Now he stood in the recycling line, his weathered face impassive behind his void suit helmet. Our eyes met briefly as I passed. I detected no accusation in his gaze, no hatred or fear, only a weary acceptance. He nodded slightly, a gesture of acknowledgement between 2 servants of the Imperium who understood the brutal calculus of survival. I found myself unable to return the gesture, my motor control momentarily compromised by an unexpected surge of emotional response. This weakness troubled me deeply. The first signs of organized resistance appeared precisely when my probability models had predicted. On the 18th day after implementing the selection protocols, at approximately 3:47 ship's time, security AusPEC's arrays detected unauthorized movement in the lower storage decks. A group of ratings had assembled near the secondary stasis chamber control room. Their heat signatures suggested at least 20 individuals, moving with purpose and coordination. I was monitoring the ship systems from the auxiliary command center when the alarms triggered. The security feed showed the group advancing through the frost-covered corridors, armed with improvised weapons and tools. Several wore partial void suits cobbled together from damaged equipment. They moved with the precision of military training, suggesting the involvement of naval security personnel among their ranks. I alerted Commissar Draylock immediately. His response was swift and decisive. Within 7 minutes, he had assembled a response team comprising the remaining naval armsmen and two servitors equipped with heavy stubbers. The Commissar himself led the team, his bolt pistol and power sword marking him as the Emperor's authority incarnate. The rebels' objective became clear as they approached the stasis chamber control room. The 42 functioning stasis units represented the only guaranteed path to survival. By seizing control of these chambers, the rebels could determine who would live to see Imperial space again. Their plan was logical if ultimately doomed. Draylock would never allow such a direct challenge to authority, regardless of the cost in lives. The confrontation occurred in Junction Corridor 7 Alpha, a narrow passageway connecting the main deck to the stasis chamber level. The confined space negated the rebels' numerical advantage, forcing them to advance in groups of three or four. Draylock positioned his forces at the far end of the corridor, behind hastily erected barricades of storage crates and detached bulkhead panels. What followed was brutal efficiency. The rebels charged the barricade with desperate courage, wielding a mixture of maintenance tools, improvised clubs, and a few sidearms likely stolen from the armory. The servitors opened fire first, their heavy stubbers cutting down the front ranks with mechanical precision. The armsmen followed with shot cannon blasts that echoed deafeningly in the confined space. I observed the engagement through the security feed, calculating casualty rates and ammunition expenditure. The rebels had no chance of success, yet they continued their assault for about 10 minutes before finally breaking. 23 rebels died in the corridor, for more were wounded severely enough to be immediately designated for recycling. The Loyalist forces suffered 3 casualties, including one armsman whose void suit was breached by a lucky shot from a stolen las pistol. Draylock ordered the surviving rebels captured rather than executed. This decision initially registered as anomalous in my tactical assessment until I processed his subsequent order. All captured rebels were to be designated as priority recycling candidates. Their deaths would serve as both punishment and practical resource reclamation. The processing took place over the next 6 hours. I was required to attend to ensure the recycler units functioned at optimal efficiency given the sudden influx of biomass. The rebels were processed conscious, without the mercy of sedation normally granted to selection candidates. Draylock decreed this as a necessary deterrent against future insurrection. The screams eventually stopped as the final rebel disappeared into the intake mechanism. The recyclers hummed contentedly, their spirits apparently unbothered by the moral implications of their function. That night, as I performed maintenance on my augmetic components in my private quarters, I accessed the ship's historical archives. The damage to the central cogitator banks had corrupted many files, but enough remained intact to establish a disturbing pattern. The Fervent Decree had suffered similar accidents 3 times in its 400-year service history. In 487, a catastrophic Jeller field failure had stranded the ship in real space for 63 days. In 712, a mysterious plasma containment breach had disabled the main engines during a routine patrol. In 891, unexplained cogitator failures had rendered navigation systems inoperable for 97 days. Each incident had occurred in the same region of space, the outer reaches of the Halo stars, far from established shipping lanes or imperial outposts. Each had resulted in similar systems failures, despite occurring centuries apart with different crews and different commanding officers. each had necessitated extreme survival measures according to the heavily redacted after-action reports. The statistical probability of such coincidences was vanishingly small. My augmetic brain calculated the odds at approximately 0.000073%, effectively impossible without some guiding intelligence or predetermined pattern. This suggested something more calculated than random misfortune, something deliberate. I cross-referenced the ship's navigation logs with the incident reports. The fervent decree had passed through identical spatial coordinates during each previous incident, within a margin of error of 0.3 light years. We had traversed those same coordinates a few days before our current catastrophe. This discovery triggered security protocols in my augmetic systems. Information this sensitive could potentially destabilize the already fragile command structure. If the crew learned that our situation might be the result of deliberate action rather than accident, the resulting panic and paranoia would accelerate our societal collapse. I sealed the data behind multiple encryption layers and deleted all traces of my search from the main cogitator banks. This information would remain mine alone until I determined the appropriate course of action. The Omnissiah teaches that knowledge is power, but also that some knowledge is dangerous when shared with those unprepared to receive it. As I completed this entry, the ship's temperature dropped another 2 degrees. The frost on my viewport had grown thick enough to obscure the void beyond. The recyclers continued their grim work in the decks below, processing the day's selection candidates. Commissar Draylock had ordered increased security around the stasis chambers following the failed rebellion. The surviving crew moved through the freezing corridors like ghosts, their void suits collecting frost, their faces hidden behind fogged helmets. I performed the necessary calculations once more. At current consumption rates, with 47 crew members now processed through the recyclers, we had extended our survival window to approximately 73 days, still far short of the 180 required to reach Imperial space. More would need to die so that some might live. And somewhere in the void around us, something waited, something that had brought the fervent decree to this same state 3 times before, something patient enough to operate on a timescale of centuries. My augmetic systems registered an unfamiliar sensation as I contemplated this possibility, a cold that had nothing to do with the failing environmental systems. The human components of my brain recognized this sensation as fear. The final selection process began 48 hours after the failed rebellion. I recorded the proceedings in the ship's primary conference chamber, my augmetic eye capturing every detail with mechanical precision. The room had grown so cold that ice crystals formed in the air with each exhalation, small diamond motes that drifted and settled on the frost-covered table. We had gathered, the final 46 survivors of the fervent decree, to determine which 2 would join the recyclers. Captain Veritax attended despite his deteriorating condition. The amputation had failed to halt the infection's progression. His skin had taken on a grayish pallor, and the Medicae's auspex readings showed multiple organ systems beginning to fail. Yet he had insisted on being present for this final selection, his authority as captain undiminished, even as his body surrendered to entropy. 2 servitors had carried him to the chamber on a Medicae gurney, his remaining limbs strapped down to prevent the increasingly frequent seizures from causing self-injury. Commissar Draylock stood at the captain's right hand, bolt pistol holstered but conspicuously visible. The weeks of crisis had transformed the commissar. Where once he had been meticulously groomed, now his uniform hung loosely on his frame and a patchy beard covered his lower face. Only his eyes remained unchanged, cold, calculating, and utterly without mercy. The mathematics of our situation had become increasingly stark. With 46 survivors in stasis chambers for only 42, 4 more would need to be processed. However, my latest calculations had revealed a further complication. The stasis chambers required more power than initially estimated. Running 42 chambers simultaneously would deplete our reserves before reaching Imperial space. The actual sustainable number was 40. I presented these findings to the assembled crew with dispassionate precision. 6 more would need to die so that 40 might survive. The temperature in the room seemed to drop further as this information was absorbed. I observed micro-expressions of fear, resignation, and calculation cross the faces of my fellow survivors. each performed their own mental arithmetic, assessing their value to the mission against the likelihood of selection. Commissar Draylock announced the final selection criteria. Four factors would determine survival: technical expertise critical to the ship's function, level of augmetic enhancement, physical condition, and loyalty demonstrated during the crisis. The Commissar had already compiled a preliminary list based on these parameters: 40 names that would continue, 6 that would not. The list appeared on the main display screen. My name was among the 40, as expected given my extensive augmentations and technical expertise. Captain Veritax's name was absent, also expected given his terminal medical condition. The captain showed no reaction to this confirmation of his fate. Perhaps he had already calculated this outcome when he first ordered the selection process implemented. More surprising was the absence of Commissar Draylock's name from the survival list. This anomaly triggered multiple analytical subroutines in my augmetic brain. The Commissar had positioned himself as the authority maintaining order throughout the crisis. His physical condition remained optimal. His skills in maintaining crew discipline would be valuable during the potential rescue and recovery phase. By all logical parameters, he should have been among the selected survivors. The explanation came moments later. Captain Veritax, his voice barely audible over the hum of the environmental systems, challenged the list. Despite his weakened state, he invoked an ancient naval tradition. As captain, he reserved the right to select his own replacement should he become unable to command. He named Chief Gunnery Officer Clave as his successor, not Commissar Draylock. The temperature in the room seemed to drop several more degrees as the implications became clear. Draylock had spent weeks consolidating power, positioning himself as the natural successor to the failing captain. Now, with a few whispered words, Veritax had upset this carefully constructed hierarchy. The captain's decision was technically within his authority, but it directly challenged the power structure that had emerged during our crisis. Draylock's reaction was immediate and predictable. His hand moved to his bolt pistol as he stepped toward the captain's gurney. The Commissar stated that the captain's judgment had been compromised by his medical condition. The infection had spread to his brain, rendering his decision suspect. For the good of the ship and the Emperor's service, Draylock would assume command effective immediately. What followed unfolded with the cold logic of a machine executing its program. Captain Veritax, despite his weakened state, had anticipated this response. A slight hand movement signaled the two Medicae servitors flanking his gurney. Their limbs, which I had assumed were configured for medical support, reconfigured with mechanical precision. Hidden weapons deployed from compartments in their chassis. Compact lasgun in one, a mono-molecular blade in the other. Draylock was fast, his bolt pistol clearing its holster before the servitors had fully deployed their weapons, but Veritax had planned this confrontation meticulously. The bolt pistol's magazine had been subtly sabotaged, causing a misalignment in the firing mechanism. When Draylock pulled the trigger, the weapon jammed, the bolt round stuck halfway into the chamber. The servitors attacked with synchronized precision. The lasgun fired 3 times in rapid succession, striking Draylock in the chest and left shoulder. The Commissar staggered but remained standing, protected partially by the carapace armor beneath his great coat. The second servitor lunged forward, its mono-molecular blade aimed at Draylock's exposed throat. The Commissar's combat training proved its worth. Despite his injuries, he pivoted away from the blade and drew his backup weapon, a compact naval pistol holstered at the small of his back. 3 shots rang out, each finding its mark in the attacking servitor's optical array. The machine collapsed, its control systems destroyed. The remaining servitor adjusted its targeting parameters and fired again. This time the Laz beam caught Draylock directly in the face, vaporizing his left eye and a significant portion of his skull. The Commissar dropped to his knees, somehow still conscious despite the catastrophic injury. With remarkable determination, he raised his pistol one final time, aiming not at the servitor but at Captain Veritax. The captain watched impassively as Draylock fired twice. Both rounds struck Veritax in the chest, the impacts causing his body to jerk against the restraining straps. Dark blood spread across the front of his uniform, freezing almost immediately in the sub-zero temperature of the chamber. His vital signs flatlined on the Medicae monitors, but his expression remained unchanged, a slight smile visible beneath his oxygen mask. Draylock collapsed seconds later, his remaining eye fixed on the captain's corpse. The commissar's last words were unintelligible, blood bubbling from his lips as he tried to speak. Then he too was still, his body slumping forward onto the frost-covered deck. The entire confrontation had lasted less than 30 seconds. The assembled crew remained frozen in place, processing the sudden violence. My own systems had recorded every detail, cataloging the event for the ship's archives while simultaneously calculating the implications for our survival equation. Two problems had been unexpectedly solved. With both the captain and commissar dead, our numbers had been reduced to 44, just two above the sustainable number for the stasis chambers. More significantly, both men had been high resource consumers due to their fully human physiology. Their deaths improved our overall survival probability by approximately 7.3%. I noted these calculations in my internal log while externally maintaining an appropriately solemn demeanor. The human components of my brain recognized the necessity of this social mimicry, though my augmetic systems found it inefficient. The deaths were mathematically beneficial regardless of the emotional response they generated. Chief Gunnery Officer Clave, now effectively the ship's commander per Veritax's final order, directed the removal of the bodies. He instructed me to oversee their processing through the recyclers, noting that their biomass would provide additional nutrition reserves for the stasis period. His tone was matter-of-fact, devoid of the hesitation that had characterized earlier discussions of the recycling process. After weeks of systematic cannibalism, even this final indignity had lost its power to disturb. I supervised the processing personally, ensuring optimal nutrient extraction from both bodies. Draylock's remains proved particularly valuable due to his excellent physical condition prior to death. The commissar's body yielded 17% more usable biomass than our previous average, a fact I recorded in the technical logs without commentary. Captain Veritax, despite his infection, still provided sufficient nutrients to justify processing rather than disposal. The unexpected surplus from these high-ranking officers allowed me to recalculate our survival parameters. The additional nutrients would support 42 individuals in stasis rather than the 40 I had previously determined. This reduced our final selection by two, leaving only two more crew members to be processed. The selection of these final two occurred without ceremony or debate. Medicay Officer Thule and Astropath Merrick volunteered, citing their deteriorating physical conditions. Thule had developed radiation poisoning during the initial disaster, its progression slow but irreversible. Merrick had never recovered from her attempt to send psychic distress signals. Her mind was fracturing, episodes of incoherence increasing in frequency and duration. Their processing was conducted with all available dignity. I administered the Emperor's piece personally, ensuring they felt no pain as the recyclers performed their function. Their biomass joined the storage containers in the stasis chamber anteroom, the final additions to our grim supplies. With the selection complete, I began the sacred rites of stasis chamber activation. The 42 chambers had been arranged in four concentric circles in what had once been the ship's primary cargo hold. Each pod required individual calibration and blessing, the machine's spirits within temperamental after centuries of intermittent use. As I moved from chamber to chamber, applying sacred unguents and reciting the proper activation litanies, I discovered something troubling. The control cogitator for one of the chambers showed evidence of tampering. Someone had accessed its core programming, modifying the stasis field parameters. Had the changes gone unnoticed, the chamber's occupant would have experienced a cascade failure approximately 30 days into stasis, a painful death as cellular degradation accelerated beyond sustainable levels. I corrected the sabotage and began a systematic examination of all 42 chambers. Three more showed similar tampering, each modified in subtly different ways to avoid pattern detection. The work was sophisticated, indicating a level of technical expertise that few aboard the Fervent Decree possessed. More concerning was the underlying implication. Someone had attempted to reduce our numbers further, perhaps to improve their own survival chances by increasing available resources. Further investigation revealed more disturbing evidence. The ship's machine spirit had not been damaged randomly during the initial catastrophe. The pattern of system failures followed a precise sequence, targeting critical systems in a specific order that maximized damage while maintaining just enough functionality for limited survival. This was not an accident or mechanical failure. It was a meticulously planned act of sabotage. The sabotage methodology matched no known pattern in my extensive archives of technical heresies. It bore elements of Mechanicus knowledge, but implemented with deviations that suggested either innovation or corruption of standard protocols. Most concerning was the timestamp embedded in the core programming. The sabotage had been implanted decades ago, lying dormant until activated by a specific set of coordinates in the Halo stars. I found myself facing a troubling conclusion. Our entire situation had been engineered. The Fervent Decree had been set up to fail at this precise location, forcing its crew into the very choices we had made. The question of why remained elusive. What purpose could be served by stranding an Imperial vessel in the void, forcing its crew to consume one another to survive? These discoveries I kept to myself as I completed the stasis chamber preparations. Knowledge, the Mechanicus teaches, is a weapon. This particular knowledge would serve no practical purpose in our current circumstances and might trigger further destabilization among the surviving crew. The cold equations of our situation remained unchanged regardless of how we had arrived at them. The final hours before stasis activation were marked by solemn efficiency. Each survivor was assigned a chamber and provided with final instructions. The ship's automated systems had been programmed to maintain minimal life support in the stasis chamber room only. All other sections would be depressurized to conserve power. The automated distress beacon would broadcast continuously on Imperial emergency frequencies, though my calculations indicated it would fail after approximately 340 standard days, far sooner than any realistic rescue timeline. I recorded these final preparations in the ship's log, noting my own calculations regarding our rescue probability. Based on historical data of vessels recovered from the Halo stars, our chances stood at approximately 0.03%, effectively zero by any reasonable standard. This information, too, I kept from the general crew. Hope, however mathematically unfounded, served a psychological purpose for those with more human than machine components. As the final survivors entered their stasis chambers, I performed one last set of calculations. The ship's trajectory would carry us toward the Gothic sector at sublight speed. Even if the distress beacon functioned perfectly, the signal would take approximately 73 years to reach the nearest Imperial monitoring station. By that time, our power reserves would have failed completely, leaving 42 perfectly preserved corpses in a dead vessel. This outcome seemed statistically certain, yet something in my analysis suggested an alternative possibility. The precision of the sabotage, the historical pattern of similar incidents with the Fervent Decree, the specific location of our breakdown, all pointed to deliberate action by an intelligence operating on a timescale of centuries. Such an entity might have reasons to recover the ship and its occupants, if only to study the results of its experiment. I recorded this final hypothesis in a data crystal implanted within my augmetic chest cavity, isolated from all ship systems. Should my body ever be recovered, this information might prove valuable to the Mechanicus or Inquisition. The pattern suggested purpose, and purpose suggested agency. Something had orchestrated our fate, perhaps to test human behavior under extreme stress, perhaps to observe our ethical collapse when faced with impossible choices, or perhaps simply to witness our suffering. As I sealed the final stasis chamber, my own, I surveyed the room one last time. 42 pods arranged in concentric circles, containing what remained of the Fervent Decree's crew. Surrounding them were the storage containers filled with processed biomass, the physical remains of our former comrades converted into sustenance. The temperature had dropped to minus 27 degrees Celsius, frost coating every surface in glittering patterns that resembled star charts. The stasis field activated around me, slowing my biological processes to near suspension. My augmetic components would continue minimal function, maintaining surveillance and recording capabilities throughout the stasis period. I would be conscious in the most technical sense, aware but unable to act for however long our journey lasted. My final calculation before full stasis engagement was a simple one, The Omnisaya teaches that all patterns have meaning. Our situation represented a pattern repeated throughout the fervent decree's history. The mathematical probability of such repetition occurring naturally was effectively zero. Therefore, our circumstances were the result of deliberate action by an intelligence with objectives beyond my current ability to determine. As consciousness faded, my augmented brain processed one final observation. In the frost patterns on the stasis chamber glass, I detected a geometric sequence matching the forbidden symbols I had discovered in the abandoned shrine. The pattern was too precise to be random, too complex to be natural. Something had marked us, something watched us, something waited. The cold equations had been calculated long before we ever entered this region of space. We had merely provided the variables for a formula written by unseen hands.